RPG Lessons Learned. When the game is over, when your players are gone, that's when lessons are learned. Hello, Brian.
Hey, Dusty. How's it going?
It's going well. So, let's see. Last week, we talked about a more recent game, probably from last year or so, the Prison Break, and the free-form, you know, no-minis, theater-of-the-mind approach that we took to that game. We're actually going to step back and talk about an earlier game.
Oh, really? Which one?
The Reavers of Harkonwold. It was the game that came packaged in the so-called Dungeon Master's Kit.
I remember the name, and I remember Harkonwold as a location. I don't remember the specific game.
Oh, yeah. This is from my completionist era of trying to knock out all the 4th edition essentials line, and this was another part of that. But before we jump straight into that content, we should probably talk about subscribing. So we have a what's it called? Sorry, an iTunes feed now?
Yeah, iTunes or Apple Podcasts for the people who use the iPhone or iPad. I was about to say iPod. I guess actually there's still iPods, right? Like the just basically if you have Apple Podcasts, search for RPG Lessons Learned and add us, and you'll get an episode every single time we post one. It's pretty awesome.
I'm actually legit excited for this for myself. I can't wait to subscribe to my own podcast.
Awesome. Yeah, I for all my stuff I subscribe to. If nothing else, it helps me know if there's anything going on.
Yeah, fair enough. All right, The Reavers of Harkonwold. So, Brian, do you remember this game at all?
Not really.
Okay, and that's okay. It was some time ago. So let me recap it and see if we can cast your mind back. We played this game over two, possibly three sessions, and it was kind of hot and cold. The first session, which I'll talk about first, was a little cold. It left us cold. You might remember this as the first game where we incorporated Mark.
Oh, yeah.
So
he played a dwarf.
He did. Yeah, he always plays a dwarf, all the way back to his days in EverQuest. But actually, in Warhammer, he always was the dwarves in Warhammer Fantasy. But anyway, this game was all about defeating the Iron Circle. So they were these guys, they were all wearing armor. You know, they were an army. They were very consistent uniforms. They all had, you know, circles printed on the chainmail on their chests. If this is jogging any memories for you.
Wasn't there like some Deus Ex Machina to actually incorporate Mark into the game? Or is that a later game?
You're thinking of Cairn of the Winter King.
Okay.
Which we'll talk about in an upcoming podcast.
Okay.
But I am proud of that, and we will absolutely cover that in Cairn of the Winter King. But no, not in this game. In this game, we incorporated him as part of your travels. You actually left Fallcrest and headed down toward the southeast, toward Harkonwold. And it's all in the Nentir Vale. I still love the Nentir Vale, the default setting from 4th edition. It started off with you guys running into some Iron Circle kind of brigands terrorizing a woman outside of her cottage / farmhouse. And it turned into the mayor of, was it Albridge? I think it was Albridge, asking you guys for help against the Iron Circle. In this game, you went into a cavern against some bullywugs to defeat some bullywugs to earn some cred amongst the druids and get help from those allies. And you also went to the Woodsinger elves to get their help. And they requested that you go, you know, defeat this lich, basically, this necromancer.
Was I playing Inigo or the Dragonborn at this point?
You were the Dragonborn by this point.
Okay.
Yeah, you were the Dragonborn for most of the Essentials line.
Yeah, okay, that helped me place it.
Okay. When you were helping out the elves and you went to this Stonehenge-looking complex and you went underground to defeat, you know, to get past some goblins and defeat some undead and defeat this evil wizard on behalf of the elves, this is when the infamous Goblin Pants story came about, that Goblin Pants. Do you remember this?
I vaguely remember the Goblin Pants. Okay. We always turn something into a joke, and I remember that being the primary joke for at least one session.
Yeah, so the story there was that Chris was playing a changeling. You know, so we were all using the 4th edition character creator. You know, all the races and classes were available, and Chris had built this character that could change, you know, shape and face and all this, and he had actually changed into a goblin to talk his way past the goblins, and one of the jokes was that his clothes didn't change. So he was a goblin that was wearing pants.
Yes, I remember that.
Okay. So learned a lot from this game. Mark was along with us, and Mark actually pointed out one of the lessons in the middle of the game, which was, it felt so tropey and unrealistic. Why would this group of elves, these Woodsinger elves, that you've been sent to befriend, you've literally been sent to ask them to pledge their army to this cause against the Iron Circle. And these Woodsinger elves say to you, yeah, absolutely. You can, you know, we will pledge our army if you do something for us. And we need you to go defeat, you know, roughly, you know, 5 to 10 goblins and a couple of undead. And if you do that, then we'll use our army to help you defend Harkonwold.
That's true.
And I actually reread the adventure this morning to see if there was any justification for why the Woodsinger Elves army, whose help that you're asking for, couldn't have taken these folks out on their own. And there's no explanation whatsoever.
That is awesome. I love that so much.
It's a plot straight out of every video. You know, hey, if you solve this really minor problem for us, we'll devote, you know, hundreds of elves to help you out. Like, no, it didn't make any sense. And I remember Mark saying something along the lines of, see, this is what I hate, or adventures where, you know, they have this army and you want their help, but they want you to solve this really minor problem that their army could just completely solve.
Yeah, and honestly, that sort of thing, I mean, that happens everywhere. I mean, that's like half the quest that I played in Skyrim over the last 2 or 3 years.
Yeah. So, and it was a wake-up call for me. You're right. I had played, you know, World of Warcraft for years and different, you know, RPG. And honestly, when you're playing a video game, that's what I love about tabletops. When you're playing a video game, you're almost conditioned by the games that you play not to question the plot lines.
Yeah.
To the point where I rarely read the text. I tend to play through games 10 years after they come out or even later. So I'm actually playing through Borderlands 2 right now, and not strictly an RPG, but very RPG-like elements. I don't read the quest text. I don't listen to what the characters say. I don't care. I keep pressing A until something appears on my minimap, and then I go there.
Yeah.
So you can get lazy as a dungeon master and rely on these video game plots, but they make a lot less sense. And it's a good caution point. They make a lot less sense in a tabletop setting where you're asking yourself, wait a minute, in this world where anything's possible, why are we doing this?
So this makes me think, if you have a table full of players that are conditioned by these video games and they are not necessarily players who are, I guess, really experienced at the whole narrative gameplay that tabletop RPGs bring. Does it really matter as long as they enjoy the game?
Good question. And contemplating that, on the one hand, I'm going to say, no, it doesn't matter. And I think it didn't matter to us at first as we played through the Red Box, as we played through a couple of other smaller adventures. We were good. We were good just following the quest text. We enjoyed the combats. We talked, you know, about how we enjoyed the really tactical combat in 4th edition, how it was one of the best miniature combat games ever. We've covered that. We were still really enjoying that aspect of tabletop role-playing games. But having said that, the minute you're exposed to someone like Mark, who has that deeper understanding and starts questioning things, it's one of those moments where you grow as a player and as a DM and you think, whoa, that doesn't make sense. I need to think about this differently. So I think you're right. It's fine until one of you grows enough to recognize that it's not fine. And then as a group, you have to all grow together.
See, at that point, all of us were actually trying to figure out the mechanics of the game and trying to understand it. And I think a lot of our focus was just getting through and making this work. Where now, if we were cast into that scenario, we would be like, WTF.
Yeah. Yeah, and to your point, Mark was the only one who kind of looked up and blinked and asked the question, and we all kind of looked at each other like, oh, that's actually a really good point. Why are we doing this? But yeah, the game was terribly plotted, and that was the first session. But let's talk about the second session now, where things got a lot better. So the second session was all about actually going up against the Iron Circle. You might remember a couple of these moments, Brian. Remember the wooden fort that you guys set fire to?
Yeah.
Yep. So you guys were sent by the mayor of Albridge out to this wooden fort. And let me take a step back and say, you'll find some of this in the adventure, those of you at home who might have the Dungeon Masters kit from the 4E Essentials line. You'll find some of this in the book for sure, but part of what made the second session better is when Mark asked that question in the first session, and we kind of looked up and blinked and looked at each other, I took that to heart for the next session, and I really changed how I ran the second part of the adventure. There were two booklets, by the way. There were two adventure booklets that came with the Dungeon Masters kit. So in the second booklet, I really changed things. This fort, this wooden palisade, this wooden fort had been built just outside of Albridge and was lobbing rocks using siege engines, using mm-hmm. basically trebuchets into Albridge. And I had the mayor, you know, send you guys out to destroy those. And that to me made sense. You're a small squad of guys who can move quickly, and you're meant to go in, get in quickly, and sabotage those things because they truly were hurting the fighting effectiveness of this entire town, you know, destroying fortifications and the like. It made sense for a small, you know, squad of guys to go and accomplish.
Let me see if I remember the mechanic of this correctly. Didn't we have to basically go in, and there were columns, may not be the right word, but areas that we had to specifically set fire to cause the fort to go.
Actually, setting fire was completely you guys' invention.
Well, right. Okay. Yes. But like as DM, didn't you set like parameters that we had to work within to say that the fort was on fire?
Well, so I had you make a dexterity check to actually successfully set a portion of the fort on fire. And the mechanics that I used, you might remember that I pulled out some aquarium stones, so some kind of red glass beads.
Yeah, exactly.
Yep, and I quickly came up with a rule on the fly to say, because I had no idea you guys were going to use fire. I have since learned, by the way, and for anyone who's never DM'd out there, be ready for this. The player's first solution to any problem is to burn things.
That's our first solution anyway.
Yeah, and you know, it makes a lot of sense in the game, so be ready for that. But I hadn't learned that yet, so I wasn't ready for you guys to say, you know what, it's a wooden fort, we set fire to it. And I had to come up with rules on the fly to talk about how this fire operated. So I took these red glass beads, and I set them down, and I said, okay, the fire will move at this speed. So around is 6 seconds, I'll say the fire will spread, you know, roughly one square every round.
Did we use an accelerant? I don't recall.
You did.
Okay. Well, that makes sense then.
Yeah. You use lamp oil. You guys all had adventurer's kits, which included a lantern.
Okay.
But the fort was very free form. I used some dungeon tiles to lay down the fort, but I ran it in a very free form way. And I don't know if you remember this, Brian. There was actually a drake, kind of an unintelligent dragon, staked in mm-hmm. the middle of the fort that you guys freed.
Absolutely.
Befriended and freed.
Uh huh.
Okay.
So, yeah. That, you know, as a dragonborn, I felt a kindred spirit with this drake.
So that drake, you know, flew off, and we'll come back to him in just a minute. But to continue the recap, another part of this session that went really well is after you guys successfully sacked this fort, do you remember ambushing the rider?
I do not.
Okay. So I presented you a plot hook to continue your adventure against the Iron Circle where you knew...
Yes. Go ahead.
Yeah, okay. Where you knew information was going to be leaving Albridge, that the fort had been destroyed and was going to be sent back to the Iron Quarter, the Iron Circle's headquarters. And I asked you guys to ambush that rider, and it was very freeform. It was the first time where I straight up presented you guys with a problem, and I had no maps pre-picked out. I had no nothing pre-picked out, and I was like, okay, you need to ambush a rider. How are you going to do it? How are you going to figure this out? How are you going to figure out where they're coming from, where they're going? And you guys, on your own, talked it over and laid out a plan that was pretty logical. You were ahead of the rider. You had gotten the message to intercept him by magical means. And you chose a crossroads mm-hmm. that you felt like, hey, if he's coming from this direction or this direction, he's probably gonna go over these crossroads. And you had laid down some tripwires that you covered up with dirt, two ropes that crossed the crossroads in an X pattern. And as soon as you guys saw the rider, you were going to yank on the rope to make it a tripwire and to take down his horse and take him down.
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah, okay. Very well. That was fun.
So I had no idea how you were going to do that. It could have been a pit trap. It could have been sniping the rider from a distance. It could have been trying to catch up to the rider in his camp at night. I had no idea. But I did have my first ever prop ready.
Mm-hmm.
It was a letter that he was carrying, and I knew, however you guys got, you know, caught up to the rider or caught this message, that I would give you this letter. So it was a prop that I felt very certain I would be able to use. It didn't rely on one specific circumstance.
Okay.
So that, I think, went really well. Do you remember that improv and how you felt about capturing that rider or killing that rider?
So it was one of those things where, so there's that creative moment when we, especially when you have to think fast on, oh, well, how are we going to do this? It's unlike the Prison Break episode last week when we just had a chance to sort of sit there and think and try and experiment. This was one of those things where it was like, well, how are we going to do this? Okay, let's trip the horse. Or, I mean, usually we're always like going after an animal, which, or a horse, which actually kind of makes me sad.
Yeah, I hadn't realized until you said that's been a theme for us.
It has. I mean, but it makes sense.
It does.
Practically, it makes sense. But it was one of those things like, well, let's try it. And if it doesn't work, we're basically SOL. And I think when we have to think fast and in the heat of the moment like that, we tend to come up with pretty good ideas, unless it involves a flaming bedroll.
Yep. So that worked. You guys got the message. You figured out where the fort was. Now, the fort in the second booklet was insane. And I never even showed you the map, Brian, but the fort where the Iron Circle was based, it was basically a dungeon crawl. And I had some gaming paper, gamingpaper.com. We have no affiliation with them, but I love their product. It's basically rolls of wrapping paper with a 1x1 grid printed on it specifically for tabletop role-playing games. And I had some gaming paper, sorry. And I had drawn out a portion of that massive fort, that massive castle, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And pretty quickly, I was like, no, you know, we can't do a dungeon crawl. The story that we're selling here, the story that I've sold to players on, is that there's this Iron Circle army marching on Harkonwold, and you guys need to marshal allies and disrupt supply chain and disrupt messengers and disrupt siege engines to make this military campaign, to affect this military campaign. And to go from a military campaign to a dungeon crawl in a fort, I couldn't do it, man. I could not do it.
Maybe I thank you after not, you know, years after not realizing that that was the case.
Yep. So what I did is I had these pre-made maps from Wizards called the Cathedrals of Chaos, I believe it was. And there was a ruined castle. And to explain the fact that the castle was ruined, I went back to the Drake. I really wanted actions that you guys had taken mm-hmm. to impact the world. So this Drake had been, you know, captured and staked and tethered by the Iron Circle. So I love the idea that, hey, maybe this Drake showed back up and kind of tore things up.
So in hindsight, could a Drake actually level something like that, especially if it had just been tied up and, you know, was subdued that way?
Well, so the way I explained it, good question, and I actually had thought of that at the time. The way I explained it at the time was that most of the Iron Circle's army was away fighting. So it was a pretty small skeleton crew left at the keep of the Iron Circle. And in fact, I just found the map, by the way, if you want to take a look at, sure. at this massive dungeon that you guys were supposed to,
yeah.
to go after. There was a skeleton crew left behind, and since he was able to bypass the main defense of any castle, which is the wall,
yeah,
he was able to tear up Jack pretty well, but it was not without consequence to the Drake. I don't know if you remember what turned into a pretty emotional scene.
I mean, I remember the Drake died. I just don't remember necessarily. Did he give up the last of his energy to fight this fight for us, or did he... Or was he wounded in the event? I don't recall.
He was terribly wounded in this fight, and you guys happened upon him as he was dying. Yeah, and I didn't know how hard you guys were going to take that, but you guys were pretty affected by that.
So just to sort of step out in real life now, it's one of those things like if I'm looking at Facebook and I see a picture or a video about a human being living in poverty and suffering, I'm like, oh, that's awful. But if I see a picture or a video of a dog or a cat who's living in poverty, I just want to cry.
I don't have that. I definitely have that in reverse.
You're the better person.
Clearly. I don't think that's true.
I do.
So people talk about their fur babies at work, and I'm like, you know, if a car ran over your dog, that would be absolutely terrible. And it's happened to me. A car's ran over a very treasured family pet, and to this day, I think about that dog, and I love that dog. But people around you treat that completely differently than if a car ran over someone in your family.
Absolutely.
So I've always had that degree of separation. Like I love pets. I love animals. I actually don't have a pet right now because it really bothers me.
I don't. As long as I've known you, you haven't had a pet.
No. I grew up with pets. I love dogs. But I wouldn't have the attention to give one right now. So I can't. I love animals enough that I don't have one right now because I can't contain it. And I don't want to have it just be at my house while I'm working all day, not getting the attention that it needs.
Now we're
way off in left field.
Now I feel terrible. Thanks,
but we all agree that we're animal lovers, right?
Yes.
So regardless of which one you love more, we're all animal lovers. So seeing that Drake, I should have known. And I really enjoyed the fact that something you guys had done, you know, a couple hours ago in the session now had an impact and had changed this part of this adventure. So I love that you guys were impacting the world. I thought when the Drake, you know, passed away, I honestly, if I'm being 100% honest here, I killed the Drake. Because my main fear was that Mike's character, who was a ranger at the time, was going to try to tame it.
Yes.
And be massively overpowered.
Didn't we do that later on?
Jason did that later on. When we started playing basic fantasy role-playing, he was a necromancer, and he kept turning corpses into his army of undead.
Oh, I thought that it's my recollection about the Drake. I had vaguely remembered that we had tamed something, or at least attempted to, which is clearly what happened here.
You did roll animal handling, because one of you actually had animal handling, which was a skill back in 4E. You actually rolled that to calm him down and free him, and he did befriend that person, but that person did not control his actions. And I was legitimately worried that Mike's character would become massively OP if he had this basically pet dragon.
That would have been great.
Oh, that's why I killed him. So I did that for very mechanical reasons to do with the game, and then boom, you guys are affected, which honestly I felt good about too. But anyway, the Drake died, and we went on to the boss fight, and I was able to use some minis, some pre-painted goblin minis, and I had this one, the main guy who ran the Iron Circle turn into a demon midway through the fight. You guys defeated him. It felt very satisfying, but that second session felt so satisfying, you know, with the wooden fort that you destroyed and the rider that you captured and the Iron Circle keep that you sacked, because I completely stepped away from the adventure. I used the basic outline of the adventure, but I had fallen out of love with the plot points and really decided that, hey, this out-of-the-book adventure is not working for me and my game or my players, and I've got to really change this up. And in changing it up, I owned it, which made me feel like I could, okay, if I own this, I can improv in the moment. And if I can improv in the moment, I can let you affect the outcome.
And was that when that first occurred to you? I mean, that sort of style of...
So it's tough. It's like we talked about last time. We've learned lessons over and over. So in that very first game we played, where I owned the adventure, mm-hmm, because I completely made it up because I didn't own any adventures at the time, I had definitely learned that lesson of, hey, if I own it, I can improv. Because you guys improvised with shooting the horse, and I went with it. In this game, when I took it and I made it my own, I could improv with it. I relearned that lesson. So it's not the first time I learned it. It's the first time I learned that, hey, out of the box, out of the book, by the book, adventures, straight out of some adventure book, may not be the best way to run D&D for me.
So, there are some games, and one that we'll talk about maybe next week, that is definitely an out-of-the-box or a scripted adventure. But it seems like most of the things that we've played, either you own it or you heavily customize, or maybe customize isn't the right way of saying it. You free us up to change direction.
Yeah, that's true. And I owe that to two people. I talked about in an earlier episode, our friend Martin telling me that, hey, if your players don't want to engage with your adventure and they want to go off in left field, you have to let them. And then Mark, in this game, in the first session of this game, asking why the elves need our help for this problem. So Yes, I really believe in letting you guys do that, and I've certainly grown that way as a dungeon master. But this is where I learned that.
Cool.
So looking back, do you see clumsiness? So I had this overwhelming feeling during this whole era, and then there's one more game we'll talk about, by the way, in the Essentials line. It's not next week, because we did some adventures of our own before we did Cairn of the Winter King. But we'll talk about Cairn of the Winter King, which is the last adventure in the Essentials line. But the whole time I was in this era of my DMing career where I was really running every adventure in the Essentials line very rotely, I felt a little clumsy and goofy. But every session you guys were ending it with, oh, that was great, that was fun. Was that true, or were you talking me up, or did you notice that I was struggling, or did you notice that the game was changing? What did you notice as a player?
So again, at this point, I was still very much trying to learn the mechanic. 4E, especially for somebody who had never played before, was very complex. And I was not as comfortable in my role as a player as I am now. So I had a lot of fun, and it was primarily from engaging with this story or in this story with you guys. So even if the story had been wrote or had things been a little awkward, one, I almost certainly didn't notice. Two, it was completely secondary to the fact that I just really enjoyed playing the game. And I don't know that I mentioned this before, but like when I came into this D&D experience, I came in very skeptical, not skeptical in the sense that I thought that I would hate it, but I did go in with a prejudice of what playing these games really implied about a person, I'll say, which now in hindsight is just, I feel terrible about it because I really enjoy the game and I hate feeling judgmental against anybody who enjoys doing this. But no, I mean, we really absolutely enjoyed it. Now, if we were thrown back in time somehow and Brian, Chris, Mike of today were playing with Dusty of 2010 or 2011, we might notice that, you know, some things were a little simplistic or things were not as, you know, or things were more contrived than they are now. As you've grown as a DM, we've grown as players, and fortunately you have grown a little faster and you're always a little farther ahead than we are as players, which makes you a good DM.
Yeah, I'm hypercritical of myself, which I think DMs to some level need, but we also need to forgive ourselves a little bit. It's funny that you say that, because I think that you and I as players got to play with the 2011 Dusty era GM at Mace last year.
You're still better than that guy.
we'll talk in an upcoming game in an upcoming podcast, we'll talk about our experiences at Mace, the Mid-Atlantic Convention Expo last year. It was my first game con, and it was fantastic, and I loved it, and I'm going back. But Brian and I signed up for a game together that was less than stellar, and we'll talk about that later. I think that's it for Reavers of Harkonwold. I learned a lot. I really valued this game at the time when Mark was like, why do we, you know, why? That question that he asked about the elves. At the time, I was pretty annoyed with him, but I'm so glad that he asked that. And I don't know if Mark listens, but Mark, if you do, I was pretty annoyed with you when you brought this up, but I grew a lot as a GM specifically because of that offhanded comment. And Mark was much more experienced than we were. If he hadn't been in that game, I wouldn't have had that moment of growth. And I've had a lot of moments of growth over the years, but I think this is one of the earliest and biggest ones.
So Mark definitely was more experienced, and I don't think it was something that I appreciated at the time, because the way that I interpreted it back then, because Mark didn't engage in the story or the game as much as we did, and at the time I thought, oh, well, Mark must feel that he's, you know, way more advanced than we are, because it's like he's pulling back, but I think he probably was pulling back a little bit so that we could still enjoy the game instead of, you know, nitpicking all of our logical inconsistencies that we certainly must have had.
Yeah, I imagine this would be like you appearing on a podcast with some people that don't have fantastic audio equipment or a good understanding of how to podcast.
I've been there. It's okay.
Yep. And you work your way through it because you recognize that they're learning, and that's exactly where Mark was.
Yeah. Way to go, Mark. You're awesome.
All right. Well, So, Brian, next week we're going to talk about our Halloween game.
I loved this game. I remember being very excited and almost proud of the job that you did with that. And I remember taking pictures and posting them to like Twitter and Facebook because I thought it was so awesome.
We should find those for the show notes.
Yeah, I know I have them somewhere.
So next week will be really interesting then because we're really going to disagree. I kind of hated that game.
Okay. I'll be excited to see what we come to.
Awesome.
So I guess we'll see you next week, Dusty.
See you next week, Brian.
People call them postmortems, evaluations, appraisals, reviews, retrospectives. We call them lessons learned, and we're sharing ours with you.